We are talking with Roland Mann today, and truth be known, this is the second time we're attempting this podcast. I had terrible internet the last time around, and so I have hopefully solved that issue. However, Roland just mentioned to me that he's got a hurricane brewing on his side of things, so we may just spontaneously lose him, and he'll just completely vanish into the ether, and who knows if we'll ever hear from him again. I hope we will. Maybe he'll reach out to us on Twitter and let us know that he's safe. But right now he's here, so we're going to talk to Roland. Roland, thank you for being so willing and so kind to come back on again and share your story.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I look forward to talking to you again, even if I do ask the same questions twice.
It's okay.
So again, I might answer them
the same. I'm not real sure.
If you answer them a little differently, that's fine. I mean, whatever. If you want to have a different life that maybe you wish to have, that'd be okay. Yeah. That's fine. But before I had my podcast thing behind me that said everyone has a story.
Right.
And that's still the name of my podcast. But I don't know if you've ever seen the show The Good Place.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is the waiting room that she walks into.
Oh,
I just thought it's great. Welcome.
Yeah.
Everything is fine.
Everything is fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah, we like it too.
Yeah. So, but anyways, the name of the podcast is Everyone's Has a Story. So we're going to start from the beginning.
Okay.
You know, you don't have to go all the way back to conception. That's fine. But, you know, maybe if you start from...
I don't remember that part.
Yeah, that's good. Where are you from, first of all? Where did you grow up? And tell me just a little bit about your childhood.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, but I grew up in Mississippi. My parents are both from a little farming community in Arkansas. I come from a family of farmers. When my parents got married, they moved to the big city so that they could get get off of the farm and out of that farming area and you know, do something else with their lives. So I grew up kind of halfway between. I wasn't a full suburbanite. Okay. I was kind of a suburban / farm thing.
Okay.
I never lived on a full on farm. Now anytime I'd go home to my grandparents and everything, I'd always go out and help milk the cows and help do, you know, run the tractors and things like that. So I had some of that experience, but it was never my, you know, every single day life.
Sure.
When the first place I can remember in Mississippi, Dad had, I want to say about 4 acres, and we had a, you know, a mini farm, but it wasn't the kind of thing that we had some cows that we mostly grew for beef. Mm-hmm. And we had, you know, a pony, and then we had ducks and chickens and, rabbits and stuff like that.
Okay.
All of which, you know, when I was a kid, they were pets, but my dad was trying to raise them, you know, so we could eat them.
Did you name them, like, did you give them names or what?
The rabbits, yes.
Oh, okay,
And the horse, yes.
But I have a friend who grows beef, and she names them, like, you know, T-Bone or New York or something like that, you know. So when it comes time to kill it, it's not that big of a deal. They're looking forward to that T-Bone or whatever. So I'm just wondering if you named your pets that. Or did you consider them pets or just like, this is food?
I was so young, I considered them pets.
Yeah, okay.
And ultimately, it's why my dad stopped doing some of it. He got rid of all the rabbits. He got rid of all the ducks because he's like, you know, every time we'd kill one, y'all cry. And he goes, I didn't like you crying. So
that's fair.
The cows are all so big and you know, when you're a kid, the cows are all so big that I never, you know, I didn't get around them too much. Mm-hmm. Or at least I kind of kept the fence mostly between us. So I grew up in Mississippi. Like I said, kind of a suburban-ish kid. Mm-hmm. Read comic. I didn't read as a kid. I would rather be outside. You know, I'd come home from school and I would, you know, I'd eat my snack, probably watch Gilligan's Island or Hogan's Heroes or something like that. And then mm-hmm. I would run outside and I would play until, you know, mom yelled at me to come in, which was usually dark, you know, dark 30. And, you know, I played with science fiction-y stuff. I had, you know, the little Star Trek action figures, mm-hmm. Which my mom called them Star Trek dolls until I got so old. I said, stop, Mom, they're not dolls, they're action figures.
They're action figures, that's right.
That's right. you know, I had a you know, I had a BB gun, you know, I'd go out shooting, you know, sparrows. My dad hated all the sparrows around, so I could shoot them. And you know, so I just wanted to be outside. And so what happened is I fell behind in school and in reading. I fell behind all my classmates. And my mom, she's an avid reader. She was always looking for ways to get me to read, get me interested. And one day in the grocery store, you know how kids are. One day in the grocery store, I spotted a comic book, and I was like, "Oh, Mom, I want this! I want this! I want this!" And you know, in her brilliance, she said, "You know, I'll buy it for you on one condition." And of course, I was like, "Yeah, anything, Mom, any whatever you say, doesn't matter what it is." And she goes, "You have to read it and tell me about it." And I'm like, "Oh, of course, Mom. Yeah, yeah, yeah." And I did. I took it. It was an Avengers. I took it home and I read it and I loved it. It introduced me to a world of characters that I had no idea who they were. Captain America and Falcon and Thor. And this was the Engelhart Perez stuff. Okay. And, you know, I didn't know who these characters were. And it just the problem was the story ended on a cliffhanger. And I'm like, what the heck? Mom, I got to have the next one. Right. And so she made the same deal. It's like, okay, we'll get the next one, but you got to do the same thing. And this went on for several months. You know, we would seek out comics, and she would, you know, she would get them on the condition that after I read them, I would tell her about them. And of course, you know, if you're the comic nut at all, you know what that leads to. I just got addicted to comics, and I just read and read. And my love for comics introduced me then to classic science fiction, as you know, a lot of comic books would talk about things like Jules Verne and H.G. Sure. Wells. And I didn't know who these people were, but but because these characters were talking about it in the comics, I wanted to know. And so that led me to reading H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. And just as, you know, within the span of about a year, I caught back up to my classmates and, you know, probably surpassed many of them just because I read so much. You know, they did what was required. I wasn't doing anything. But then once I discovered it, I did far more than was required because I loved it, you know.
So your mom was a genius.
Oh, my mom was a genius. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 She knew what she was doing. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. And that paid off. So let me ask you, do you still collect comics then? I mean, do you?
I do. Okay. Is this going to be audio only?
No.
Okay. So
is that good?
No, that's fine. Okay. I don't care. So as you can see here, these are comic book boxes. Now I'm going to lift the screen because my wife is not in here to yell at me.
Okay.
So you can see if it doesn't fall down.
Oh my goodness. Those are all comics?
These are all comic books? Comic book boxes. And of course they go all the way over to there. Right. Wow. I don't know if you can see this rack here. I got one of these big sort of industrial black racks, and there's this one here, there's one there, and there's one there. Wow. And they're full of comic books. So, but I keep the sheet up because my wife says that when I stream, she goes, "Those are ugly. You don't want they're ugly and they're distracting. You need to cover them up." And so that's why I have this black screen behind that's me fair because enough. Yeah.
So
the answer is yes, I do.
Yeah, obviously. And so those boxes then, those are years worth of comic book collecting right there?
They are, going back to about 1974.
That was the year I was born. Anyway, so I had to throw that out there. But,
that's okay. I was young.
Well, so how many, what was your favorite comics? You mentioned the Avengers, and that was the first comic book that your mother had bought you. But what other comic books did you end up getting into?
I was very much into the Avengers and Spider-Man. And as a result of the Avengers, I loved Captain America. If you were to ask me to pick out my three favorite comics as a young reader, it would have been Avengers, Captain America, and Spider-Man.
Okay. So you were easily a big Marvel type of a person.
Oh, I was. Once I discovered what that was, I was clearly a Marvel zombie.
Team Marvel.
Yes. Team Marvel. I was Team Marvel.
Did you like any... This is going to get kind of nerdy, and I'm not really a big comic book fan, and it's not because I don't like them. It's just that I never really got into them.
Right.
But I do know kind of the distinction between DC and Marvel.
Right.
I mean, who really doesn't at this point, yeah. I guess. But I do remember, you know, being young and really gravitating more towards the Marvel comics because the characters felt more relatable, more human, I guess you could say, than a lot of the DC characters, save maybe Batman, but he was still a billionaire, so you know, how could he really relate to him? But what was your reason for the Marvel, you know, liking the Marvel maybe more than the DC? Was it the same kind of deal or?
Yeah, well, I think there were a couple of reasons. And of course, if you'd have asked me back, you know, as a 7, 8, 9, 10 year old, I don't know that I could have answered it in the same way.
Sure.
But certainly looking back at on it now, there were so many, you know, and I think Marvel's is getting in. This is probably far geekier than what you want. I think Marvel's getting into this weird zone now. Mm-hmm. But part of what I didn't like about DC back then is they had all these multiverses. And you could read Batman here and Batman there and Batman here. And yet they weren't the same Batman and they didn't walk in the same circles. And that confused me. I'm like, well, wait a minute. How come this guy, this Batman knows him here, they're best buddies, but over here they're fighting. And they don't, you know, doesn't make any sense. You know, they had all the different versions of Earth. Marvel was all one family. They all lived in the same world and they, you know, had these crossovers. And that was not confusing to me. Of course, I think, you know, Marvel's multiverse now, I think, is getting into that. I think they're going to run into the exact same problem that DC had, and that they're going to lose readers because people just can't keep up with that. You know, and casual fans and casual readers, which is what the majority of people are not going to be able to follow and keep up with that. So there's that. And then there's the relatable thing that you mentioned. Superman was always, you know, so all powerful to me that it didn't seem like, well, you know, you can't beat him unless you have kryptonite, you know? And so there was never any real risk. Oh, here comes Superman. Battle's over, know?
Yeah. Well, the one thing I'll give DC is honestly, I really, I think the Joker is hands down probably the best villain ever created.
Yeah,
I love the joke. I don't know what it is about him. He's just so maniacally terrifying. and it's because he just completely believes in chaos. I mean, there's really no rhyme or reason what he does, except he just likes chaos.
Yep.
And I think that's probably why the Dark Knight or whatever it was, the Nolan was so successful because it really, really captured that this guy just wants anarchy. I mean, complete anarchy. That's all
he wants.
He's
just nuts.
Yeah, that's it. That's bottom line. And there was no storyline. That was, I think, the cool thing about Nolan's Joker is that there's no back story to the Joker. He just is the Joker, you know?
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, I don't know. So let's get back to your childhood again. So, so you really, you got into comics, you started reading really good classic science fiction, Jules Verne, those type of people. How did that influence you growing up? Did you start to say, hey, I want to write books or comic books or what happened?
You know, I did. I was, you know, I, as a Southerner, you know, we naturally tell stories. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I come from, you know, not a super large family, but I come from a big family. You know, my mother is one of four and my father is one of four. Mm. So, you know, we would get together and with all my cousins and everything, there was a whole bunch of us running around the house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't, I mean, it was just, you go there and you sit down and you just start telling stories. And now usually they're stories about, you know, you usually tell stories on yourself, you know, things that I did or that was stupid or things that my buddy did when, you know, my uncles went out to, I had one uncle that goes to deer camp every year and they're always telling deer camp stories that are goofy. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was he raised beagles and was a hunter, and he was always telling stories about that. So there were always stories to be told. Almost all of them were, you know, humorous. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, you would just kind of get, you'd eat, you know, everybody would have fun all through the day. But at the end of the day, you'd kind of settle down and everybody, you know, belly's full. You just started, people just started, you know, going around and telling stories. And it wasn't like taking turns. It was just like, you know, hey, this is what happened. Well, let me tell you about this. Well, you know, old Fred did this and then this happened. And, you know, my grandfather ran he also ran a record service in the really small town.
Right?
And so he had a police radio that was always on in the living room. And it was funny because whenever that came on, dead silence. And it's like, okay, I don't have to go, right? Because if it was a wreck, he was going to have to go get the wrecker and go get it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that was just kind of a natural, you know, thing for me is that it was storytelling. We like to tell stories. We love to tell jokes. And so I began to, because of my interest in science fiction and my interest in comic books, I just kind of started to do that when I was in junior high. I just started, you know, I wanted to draw. I wanted to, you know, I'm not an artist today. People, you know, will ask me, oh, well, do you draw today? Oh, no. I know enough about it that I can communicate with you. If you're an artist, we can talk about things, but my hand, and I studied a little bit of art in college, but my hand and my eyes do not communicate in that kind of way that it just, I know what I want to draw, but it doesn't work out that way. Yeah, I look at it and go, well, gee, that's not what was in my mind.
you know, I hear you. Yeah.
But, you know, I still took that and I created my own, you know, I created my own super group. And of course, if you look at the stuff I did in seventh grade, you know, it was all half of them were easily, oh, yeah, that's Captain America. That's the Beast. That, you know, you could easily spot who is who.
Sure.
And then in.
But you started to create your own comics that early then.
Okay. I did. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I had a friend who is still a friend today. I had a friend I met at school, and he was an equal comic geek. His name's Barry Gregory. Barry and I, we used to always talk about the comics, you know, because we both read mostly the same things. He did read more DC, and he always tried to get me into the DC, but I'm like, yeah, I don't care. But we read, you know, we both loved the Avengers. And he was always trying to get me to read the Justice League. And I would read the Justice League, but I'm like, yeah, I don't understand. There's like 50 of them. There's 7 Avengers. I'm down with that, you know? Yeah. But yeah, we would, we even did a little crossover. We had, our two teams crossed over and, you know, we split the duties. We split the storytelling. I think we ended up doing like 4 issues, all drawn on notebook paper. And, you know, half of the images were traced and stuff like that. But, but yeah, we were creating, all the way back in junior high.
Oh, wow. Wow. So did that follow you all the way through high school then?
It did. It did. It did. You know, and it's funny because, you know, I know you can't really you see me here, but, you know, I'm 6'4". I'm a big guy. And I was always into sports. And so I was a little bit of an anomaly in that, you know, I was into sports, but I also was the guy who sat in the back of the room and read comic books. Mm. And, you know, so when people talk about getting picked on, it's like, you know, I was never really picked on.
So you had your foot in both worlds, basically.
Yeah, I was
you were the sporty geek.
Yeah, I was. And so, you know, I mean, some of my jock friends kind of poked at me. Oh, look, Rose reading Spider-Man again. But, you know, that was about as far as it got. No one ever, you know, dumped water on my head or gave me you know, again, I was a big guy, so it wasn't a worry that I ever had. But I did always know that, okay, I'm the weird one because I don't know anyone else other. So I went to a different school in 10th grade, and so I left my friend Barry, you know, he stayed in the other school, I went to another school, so I was really the only one in my school that I knew of. We hit it back then, you know. I was the only one in my school that read comics. So yeah, I clearly had my foot in both worlds. Wow. I love sports. I played football, played baseball. I was on the basketball team. I'll just leave it at that. And I was on the soccer team as well.
You were tall, right?
I was tall. That's exactly it. Yeah. My job on the basketball team, the coach would say, come here, Roland. I'm like, yeah. He goes, see that guy? Go, yeah, coach. He goes, foul him. Yeah, coach, I can do that. I would go in and I would foul the dude.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah. I think I could jump maybe 2 inches. Wow. Yeah. Couldn't dribble. Couldn't do it. I was just on the team.
Yeah. That's fair.
But yeah, so I kept doing it, and I will tell you, kind of a turning point for me was when I was a senior. Mm-hmm. I took a creative writing class in high school. It was only, you know, half a semester. It was one of those. I was a senior and I was just trying to get the bare, you know, I'd already had most of my credits and I was trying to squeak out as little as I could because after football, in the second semester, you know, after January, I left school and I went to work. So I would leave school at 12 o'clock or something. I'd go to my job, you know, I'd go work, you know, 8 hours. And I've been working, you know, since I was 13. Mm-hmm. But this teacher, she was unlike any other teacher I had ever had. I would write weird stuff. She would encourage it. right?
Really?
I would write about superheroes, and she would, you know, and I look back on it now and go, yeah, that was pretty bad. But she was very encouraging. She was like, you know, explore this, explore that. You should do this with these characters, you know, how about doing that? And she never, ever made it sound like it was a terrible, stupid idea to do. I wrote some science fiction alien stuff, and I wrote some superhero stuff, and she was super encouraging, encouraged me to do more of it. And I think that was kind of, for me, the point where I'd always loved comics, but that was kind of, for me, the point where I was like, you know, I might could do this. I wonder what it would take to do this. Part of my problem was I'm a first generation college student. And no one in my family, you know, of course, in Mississippi, it's not really a publishing mecca, right? I mean, you know,
sure.
So I couldn't really ask anybody, how do you go do comics, you know? Yeah. I started off in college. When I went to college, I started off as a computer science major. I spent 2.5 years in computer science and decided, this is terrible. Yeah. I hate this.
It took you 2.5 years to decide that, though?
Well, you know, part of it was my dad. My dad was like, you know, because I told him I wanted to go to be a writer. And his question, you know, and it's a simple
question.
How
do you make money out of that?
That's exactly what he said. How are you going to make money? How are you going to feed your family? How are you going to take care of your family? The problem was I couldn't answer that. I was like, I don't know, Dad. I really don't know. And like I said, there were no resources for me. I couldn't go ask anybody.
So we're talking early 80s, mid 80s?
Yes.
When are we talking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I graduated high school in 1983. So,
during time frame, I mean, creative writing. I mean, today, I think a lot of parents would probably be like, hey, yeah, go do whatever you want, kind of a thing, you know? I mean,
follow your dream.
Yeah, and it seems easier probably to break into maybe some of that kind of business than it would have been in 1983 or, you know, when you graduated college in the mid-80s. It probably was a lot different back then.
Yeah, very much
because,
so.
Because, you know, the door, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all of these, avenues that you could pursue. It was really a cut and dry, and the people who guarded those doors, the gates, were right there. So
there were no streams, there were no podcasts, there were no, you know, none of that.
Yeah, no Kickstarters, you know,
no Kickstarters.
Yeah. Wow,
that's right.
And did it take you that long to convince your dad this is what I'm going to go to do, or did you just finally say, I'm done, I'm going to go do it?
I didn't tell him.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. That's fair.
I didn't tell him.
Were you living on campus at this point? Were you away from home?
Yeah. I was away from home. I moved off to go to college. Not very far, but I moved off to go to college.
Sure.
I was 2.5 years into it and decided I hated the math. I enjoyed computers, but I hated the programming, because programming then was a whole lot different than it is now. I mean,
what'd you have back then? Basic? I mean, no,
well, listen, we had Basic, we had RPG, we had COBOL, we had Fortran, and these are all math heavy.
Very much so.
Yeah. And you know, RPG used all the card readers, and, you know, I mean, I'm talking about literal cards flipping through, you know, and it was just, it was very much a struggle for me. And I found that I was enjoying my English classes, right? Even though I was reading stuff I didn't really want to read, I wasn't really a big fan of a lot of the literature that they had us reading. I was enjoying kind of the idea and what English was. 2.5 years in, I changed my degree to English and creative writing. Didn't tell my dad until I was getting ready to graduate. And all he said was, yeah, I knew.
I'm like, there you go. And he didn't say anything to you.
He didn't say a word. Yep.
So,
didn't say a word.
How far did that set you back? Had you been taking English courses all the way along, or did that set you back? Because I would assume that the computer science major and the English major are two different tracks and didn't really, you know, cross very much.
Yeah. Oddly enough, only a year. I kept telling everybody I was on the 5-year, 4-year program.
Yeah. So, I was on the 20-year program myself, so you did a little better than me.
I finished in 5 years and not 4. So
that's good. And then you got, so your degree was in creative writing.
Yes.
And did you, in our last talk that got cut off on now you went to school and you got you went to graduate school. That's what I'm trying to say.
I did. Yeah. But that didn't come until later though.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So once you got done with college, then did you stay in Mississippi? What happened?
I did. Okay. So while I was in college, probably about the time I decided I was going to change to creative writing, I started submitting. I started submitting stories to Marvel, to DC, Isaac Asimov's science fiction and fantasy, all these magazines that used to exist that no longer exist, Omni and places like that.
Yeah.
I just started submitting right and left. And then probably when I was a, 87, 88, probably when I was a junior, I guess, I met Stephen Butler through just a fluke chance meeting. And discovered that he also wanted to be, do you know who Stephen Butler is by any chance? You're not a comic book geek. Yeah. So he's a comic book artist, been drawing comic. I mean, he's done Spider-Man, Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay. Kind of it's stuff. Like, yeah. I feel like I've heard the name, but yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people more recently know him for Sonic. Okay. Anyway, so I met Stephen.
Not the terrible version from the movie, right?
That No. Yeah. 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 No. He's the comic book stuff.
Gotcha.
But come to find out that he had been doing the same thing. He'd been submitting his penciling samples, his art samples, out to publishers. And so this would have been in 87, okay? 86 is when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were published, right? Mm-hmm. So comics were kind of experiencing this black and white boom at the time. And so Steven and I just kind of got together. We said, you know, if the Turtles can do it, we can do it. Mm-hmm. So we put together our own thing. He had a suite mate. Stephen lived in a suite of about, I can't remember, 8 or 10 guys, something like that. And one of his suite mates was also an artist who wasn't that interested in comics, but he loved science fiction and that kind of thing. This artist's name was Mitch Bird. So we put some comics together and decided that we were going to call ourselves Top Comics and we were going to publish comics. Mm-hmm. So we did. We made some comics. We solicited to all the distributors at the time. We got orders back, and we got orders for about 4,500 copies. And we're like, okay, now what do we do? Now we got to print some stuff.
Now you got to make it happen.
We didn't have any money. I mean, we were college students, right?
Yeah.
So we were in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. So we went to all the banks, right? Now, I love Mississippi, don't get me wrong, but what I'm about to say is not going to shine them in their most glorious light. Steve and I both, you know, we put on ties, right? We put on ties and we went out to, and we took our purchase orders, right? These were purchase orders from the distributors. We showed them.
Guaranteeing you have the.
Yes. And we said, we want a loan so that we can pay for the printing for these things. Now, in essence, they all said the same thing. It was like, comic books, huh? I ain't never given no loan for no comic book before. Can you use a tractor with that?
Oh my gosh.
No, we don't need a tractor. We need money to pay the printer, who, by the way, is in Waynesboro, which is a little town south of us. Like, they're in we pay him, and then in 30 days, they're going to pay us this much money. We're going to make money, and then we'll pay you when we get that money. I don't know. I ain't never had no loan for no comic book before. I don't know. We went to, I kid you not, I don't remember the exact number. It was about 10 of them. We went to 10 banks, every bank in Hattiesburg. Nobody would give us a loan.
Oh, wow.
So we're like, okay, now what do we do? So we ended up canceling the orders.
Oh.
We photocopied them all.
Okay.
Sent them out to publishers. I said, look, we tried to do this. We didn't know what we were doing. We need some help. You can see this is what we got ordered, right? This is the other kind of orders we had. So we ended up picking up a company picked us up called EF Graphics, and they printed us in color. And I actually have something here handy to show you. This is actually film from 1989. Okay, this is just the proof here. But if you look up under here, this is actually film.
Oh, wow.
Like you would have had on, I don't know if you ever remember film from cameras.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
There's four plates here, CMYK.
Yeah.
And they would put them together in the old style and come up with this. This was going to be our cover for the second issue, okay? This never saw print. And so the reason this is out, I got this wild idea to scan each of the plates guess what? It works.
Oh, yeah?
I scanned each of the plates into Photoshop, and I've been kind of manipulating it, trying to line them up. It works! I didn't know it would
right
work!
Right on!
Holy mackerel! So, that yeah, I'm gonna probably do something with this just for fun. But yeah, so the EF Graphics published it in color, which at the time, you know, color was easily twice as much for the printing cost, and so they went out of business. they were printing us and some others, and they went out of business. But we took those comics, and I think I have one in the box right under me here. I keep a box of comics here for quick reference. Yeah, here we go. EF Graphics. This was the comic that the EF Graphics printed, and as you could see, it was in color.
Yeah.
So we took these and we took photocopies of issues 2, 3, and 4, which we had already finished, maybe even some of 5, because we'd been working on it for a while, right? Mm-hmm. And said, okay, well, we tried to publish it, that didn't work. EF Graphics picked us up, they went out of business. Now we're looking for somebody else. This time we got the attention of some of the bigger independent press publishers, and that's when we got picked up by Aircell, which was a division of Malibu Comics.
Okay.
And gotcha. And then we ran in black and white with Aircell for about 2 years.
Because it was cheaper to do black and white.
Yeah, yes, right. It was okay. far cheaper to do black and white. Hmm. Yeah, and the orders that Aircell got were far better than what we got with Top Comics, but
sure,
because they were much bigger organization. But
right, and so those comic books that comic strips that you were just showing me now, your friend Steven did the
Stephen
artwork
Butler.
On those, and then is that correct?
Mitch actually did the artwork for Cat and Mouse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Steven and Mitch both did it. Steven inked like the first 3 issues.
Okay.
And then Steven went to draw a different series.
Oh, okay.
While Mitch and I stayed on Cat and Mouse.
Okay. Gotcha. And you did the storyline.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
Gotcha. All right. Well, then you were at Malibu.
Yes.
And how long, and this is the Cat and Mouse comic strip that was distributed through Malibu or what?
Yes.
Say that again.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
Just want to be sure I'm tracking here with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before I embarrass myself, I guess.
it's all good.
And so did you tell me last time that Malibu was picked up by Marvel eventually? Is that what happened?
Yeah, Malibu was actually purchased by Marvel.
Okay.
And because we're talking about it, I have to say one thing real quick. The rumor that still exists out there on the internet, and I don't know why, was that Marvel bought Malibu for the coloring department. That is absolutely 100% false. It was just a business move. Mostly they bought them mostly Marvel bought Malibu for the market share. DC had been Malibu needed an influx of cash because they had spent a lot of money and there actually was a point in time in the early 90s when there was a huge boom that's kind of why I got into comics. There was a huge boom in the late 80s and then the early 90s, and there was a lot of money in comics. Mm-hmm. Okay. But then things began to decline rather quickly. So Malibu was already kind of looking around for investors. At one point in time, I thought we were at Paramount Pictures was the movie people were actually looking at us. I thought we were going to become Paramount Comics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did they ever go into the comic business at all or not?
Not that I know of, but they loved the way that we were handling, and I didn't do this, it was with somebody else, but they loved the way that we were handling Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Oh, we love the way you got. We don't like the way DC handles the Star Trek books. We love the way you do it. And in fact, we want to, maybe buy you, and then you do all the DC book, all the Star Trek books, right?"
Mm-hmm.
So there was a brief period of time when I thought that was going to happen. Mm. DC, though, they talked to the boss, and I wasn't part of this. I was, I was upper level editorial, but here's the top, and I was right here. I didn't know this part. But DC had been poking around for about 6 months. They were doing due diligence. They were exploring the books. They were looking at the offices. They were, just examining all the. I mean, they were getting ready to purchase the company, so they were, doing due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel got wind of it, and literally in less than 2 weeks, Marvel swooped in, purchased the company.
Really.
Yeah, because if DC had purchased Malibu, it would have taken the total market share, DC and Malibu combined, above Marvel.
So Malibu was that big then?
Yes.
See, unfortunately, I don't have a reference for Malibu or what they released, but so they were that big where Marvel was concerned.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, there was Marvel, there was DC, and then there was, depending on the month, and I'll explain it in just a second,
okay.
There was Dark Horse and
Dark Horse I've heard of.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they've been Dark Horse and Malibu got their start at the exact same year, 1986.
Okay. All right. Now, what has Dark Horse released? Because I know I've heard of them somewhere.
They did The Mask. They did Aliens. Oh, they did Predator. They do a lot of licensed properties.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's the asterisk that I always say there. Malibu was number three, unless Dark Horse did an Aliens or Predator book, and then we were number four.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, you got that audience that's already there.
Yes.
Do so. So when you guys combined then with Marvel, how did that affect you personally as far as your employment is concerned, and then how did it affect your comic?
When Cat and Mouse had already ended by that time. So okay. I had actually moved to California and became an editor with Malibu. So when they offered me the job of editor, cause I had been doing some of that for them already freelance. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how they offered me the job. And so when I went out there, the unwritten agreement was, if you come out here, you're going to get a greater opportunity to write.
Okay.
Well, that didn't happen.
Didn't pan out. Okay.
No, I did write some while I was out there. So it's not like I didn't write anything. I did write some and I'm, thankful for that. I got to work with, one of my favorite pencilers in Mike Zeck. He did the Punisher that a lot of people are familiar with.
Sure.
Yeah. He's the guy who designed the new Black Spider-Man costume.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yep.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
So I got to do a miniseries with him. So that was a lot of fun. So I did get to do some, but I didn't get to do the kind of writing that I thought I was going to get to do.
Okay.
But when Marvel purchased us, it was really kind of exciting because, I was a Marvel zombie. And so the idea that, I was going to become a Marvel editor simply because they bought the company that I was working for.
Yeah.
I mean, what the heck?
Right.
So I was very excited the first time I got my paycheck and Spider-Man was on it. It was just cool.
Heck yeah.
It's the kind of thing I took it home and I showed, look, Spider-Man is on my paycheck. Look. I was very excited.
So now everybody probably asks you this question. And so I'm going to just join the crowd. I'm sure you've met Stan Lee then, right?
I did. We had lunch with him.
Oh, sweet. Was he a nice guy?
Yep.
He was a nice guy.
He was everything you imagined him to
was
be
he really?
And more.
All
absolutely.
Right. Wow.
And that's, the way you imagine him being is exactly like he was.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. We had about a, I can't remember exactly. This was before cell phones and selfies. And I wish I had a camera.
Yeah.
But he went out to, when Marvel first purchased the company, one of the things that our editor in chief said, when Marvel said, what do you want? Our editor in chief said, we want to have lunch with Stan Lee. And so they said, we think we can arrange that. And we're like, yes. Right.
Oh, wow.
So it was me and I think four or five other editors went out to lunch with Stan Lee and I got one of the great seats, right? There were two, right? Yeah. Cause he has two sides. I got to sit on one side of it.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and we just listened to Stan, I couldn't even tell you what we had or where we went, but I just got to listen to Stan Lee tell stories for, 3 hours.
That would have been amazing. That really would. That would have been
very much so.
I mean, every time I see characters created by Stan Lee, I'm like, how do you even have enough imagination? I couldn't even come up with one of these characters, and he's created all of these characters that are now a foundation of who you are. If you live in an America or slightly a geek, who Spider-Man is, or it's just like, what? To create one is amazing, but to create that massive repertoire is just amazing. But
yeah. Very, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's exactly like you would imagine.
That's pretty cool.
I always say, just close your eyes and imagine what it is. That's exactly what it was.
That's pretty amazing.
It was fantastic.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So how long then did you last at Marvel?
So Marvel bought us, bought Malibu in 94.
Uh-huh.
As I already said, the industry was, very quickly tanking, and it wasn't just Malibu.
The whole industry?
The whole industry was tanking.
Why was that, do you think? Was it because computers were starting to take off, or what was it?
I, I, that's probably going to require you asking someone who studies more of the whys and wherefores.
Sure.
I have some ideas and some thoughts about it, but one thing that a lot of people like to blame is the baseball card crew. Apparently there was a lot of speculators in the baseball card community. Mm-hmm. And when that crashed in the 80s, they all jumped to comic books. Right. So they began speculating on comic books. And the thing about it is, you know, you have something like at the time it was speculated. Now, and again, please, if anyone's doing academic research, don't quote this. Right. But at the time it was speculated that there were roughly 300,000 comic fans. OK, regular buying comic fans. Marvel and DC both used to release because they were it was law. They had subscriptions through the mail. So once a year they had to release in their comic books what their circulation was, right? And so they would release what their highest circulation was, what their lowest circulation was, what the average circulation was, right? So you could kind of get an idea of what they sold. And they sold, you know, books like Spider-Man sold anywhere between 250 and 350,000 copies, right? Which is kind of why people, you know, estimated there were roughly 300,000 fans, or I should say buyers. So in the early 90s, then when some of these comics come along and, you know, X-Men sells a million copies, well, who's buying these copies? Then next thing you know, X-Factor comes along, and I may be getting the books out of order. The next one comes along and it sells 3 million copies. Mm-hmm. And it's X-Men, wasn't it? Because Jim Lee was the one. And it comes along, it sells like 8 million copies or 5 million copies. And then the Death of Superman comes along, and then it sells like, you know, 5 million copies, 8 million copies, something like that. You know, the thing about it is all the people in comics, those 300,000 people were going like, yeah, who's buying all this stuff? Because we're not buying that many copies. Now, admittedly, there were a lot of those people who were buying, I'm going to go buy 5 of these, because they're going to be worth money, and in 10 years, I'm going to sell it. Well, the problem is everybody has a copy of X-Men 1 now. Everyone has, you know, multiple copies of Spawn number 1, because that was happening when a lot of that was going on, you know?
How do we call that?
Yeah. And so so I think what happened is because the speculator, whether it was the card people coming in or not, or just, you know, comic people speculating, I think what happened is pretty quickly they realized that these weren't fast investments, and there weren't that many people buying, and the orders just began to tank. People were like, yeah, I am not order, because retailers were ordering a bunch of them. Retailers were saying, yeah, you know, I'm making up numbers here, but if they sold normally like 20 copies of X-Men, they're ordering 200 copies, right? Well, they're stuck with, you know, 150, even if they do sell more, they're still stuck with 150 copies in the boxes that they're unsold. And so they still paid for those. Right, so retailers began to go out of business, orders began to decline, and it was just really red. We lost all kinds of comic book retailers in the late 90s, and that's when publishers began to go out of business right and left. I mean, a lot of independent publishers went out of business. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is Marvel had just gone public. 92, 93, something like that. So they were a publicly traded company now, and their stock had doubled, split again.
Really? Wow.
Yep. But then when the crash began to happen, it went and it got down to about 2 cents a share.
Oh, no.
It opened up around $20, $25. I can't remember exactly. Around $20, $25, got up to about 50 and split. Dropped back down to about 30, got up to about 50 and split again, and then just tanked all the way. And they took it off the market when it got down to about 2 cents.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a lot of people with Marvel stock lost a lot of money. I guess if they held on to them, I don't know what it's worth today. It's probably worth something today. But what happened then is when Malibu was purchased, the CEO of Marvel went around purchasing companies. He bought Malibu, he bought Heroes World, he bought Panini Stickers, he bought other companies, and then he went back to his shareholders and said, see how great a CEO I am? I'm growing the company, right? Well, and then when everything tanks, they fire him, the new guy comes in, and you know what the new guy does, right? So he cuts Panini Stickers, cuts Heroes World, he cuts Malibu, and then he goes to the shareholders. See what a great CEO I am? I'm trimming the fat, right?
Trimming the fat.
And so I lost my job on a day when it was a two day period when 400 people lost their jobs at Marvel and Malibu to combine. Ooh. Yeah.
So that
it was funny because it's funny now. Marvel was in the middle of a promotion called the Marvolution, right?
Okay.
Well, as you might imagine, you know, we nicknamed it the Marvelcution.
Ouch. Wow. That is, yeah. I didn't, that 400 people. Is that what you just, wow. Yep. That's a lot. Yeah. Wow.
About 200 at Marvel and about 200 at Malibu.
Okay. Wow.
So, division of Malibu ended up getting cut.
Okay. So Malibu was, they're dead in the water at that point in time. They were nothing.
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
Wow. So at that point, then what did you do? Did you go back to Mississippi or what?
No, I went home and cried. my wife had come out there and she'd gotten a job at a college. She's a college administrator. Mm-hmm. So, she got a job at a college there. And when that happened, we started looking to come home to Mississippi. We're like, you know, do I want to stay out here? We didn't really like California.
Were you in the LA area or Bay Area? Where were you at exactly?
LA area. Yeah, okay. I was in just north of LA in a place called Calabasas, Thousand Oaks. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
A little bit.
Yeah. It's just north. You hear everybody talk about the valley?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I lived in the valley.
Oh, okay.
And then I went over one hill and then I was in Calabasas where
gotcha.
The company was.
Yeah. Okay.
But we didn't really like, my daughter was born out there and we were like, we don't really like it out here. We're too far away from our family. You know, we're both very family oriented and we're like, we want to be closer to home. And so she started looking for work and she ended up going back. She ended up being offered a position at Mississippi State, which is where she earned her master's degree from. She was at Mississippi State when I was working as a freelance writer, mm-hmm. getting her master's degree. And I moved when we moved out to California, she had just finished her master's degree. So she was out there with a master's. So they offered her a job and she decided that, well, she's here. So she's going to go back for her PhD. So she started going back for her PhD. Well, I decided, you know what? I know how to do comics now. When I was doing Top Comics with Steven, I'm like, I didn't know what I was doing. I knew how to make the comic, but I didn't know how the business part of it worked.
Sure.
And my thoughts were, hey, I know what I'm doing now. Right. I'm going to go do it again. Well, silly me. I didn't think of the industry is in a bad way. It just tanked. You lost your job for a reason.
Yeah.
And so I did. I started Silverline then and I published from about 97 to because I lost my job at Marvel, you know, canned everybody in 96. We moved back in late 96 then. And I started Silverline in 97 and I published 13 books, from 97 to about 2000 and early 2001 before calling it quits. Cause I lost way too much money. And my wife said, you can't lose any more money. You got to stop that. And so that's when I decided to go back for a degree.
Okay. And then, so what did you end up going back to school for?
Well, so I was in school at first, for history. I was going to be, I was going to study American history. I'm still an avid American history nut. I was going to study American history and I was going to go teach at a college. Mm-hmm. But again, this was in the days of email was around, but the internet was very much in its infancy and she got a job offer before either of us could finish. She had a job offer before she could finish her PhD and before I could finish my master's in a state next to it. She got a job offer in Alabama.
Okay.
And what happened is the offer was she would skip a level and go up to the next job.
Oh.
And so, so it was an awesome opportunity for her. So we debated and debated and decided, okay, let's do that. And so we did that and I ended up working for an advertising company there for about a year, which I hated because he was crooked. He was crooked. And then I decided I'm going to go back and they didn't have a history program there. I decided I was going to go back and get an English degree and teach you. I was still going to do kind of the same thing, but instead of history, I was going to get English. And, so I got my master's degree in, English American literature and started teaching immediately. And I know because
on the college level,
Yes, on the college level. I started a junior, started teaching at a junior college there. Mm-hmm. And I know because you and I talked about this a little bit the last time. I had a life-changing event at that same time. So my life completely, you know, took a different turn. I became a believer, and my whole life went a different direction. I actually gave up writing.
Because of that?
Because of that, yeah.
Why is that?
Well, so I looked at it and I examined it and I said, you know, here's the deal. A lot of people, they might want to argue with me. That's fine. They can believe what they want to believe. But ultimately I said, you know, this was a talent, because as I began to study, the weird thing was, when I became a believer, I kind of approached it from the aspect of academia, right? This is kind of where I had the circles that I had come from with my wife and everything. And so when I became a believer, or on my path to that, that's what I was doing. I was reading the Bible, studying all these things. I was trying to figure all this stuff out. And I said, you know, I realized that, well, this is a talent that God gave me. And essentially what I've done is I've squandered it. And so I don't need to do that anymore. I need to put that behind me, and I need to move forward with this new thing. Ultimately, you know, a couple of years later, you know, God smacked me upside the head a few times and
said,
yeah, I gave you the talent, yes, but I didn't tell you to quit. Just use it in a different way now.
It takes, I think it actually, for those of us who become, it sounds like you probably became a believer a lot later in life than I did, but I was still.
I was an adult.
Yeah, and I was still, you know, a late teenager, so I didn't grow up in church. I'd been to church maybe twice when I was a kid, so I think when you become a believer and you hit that point, I think there's a certain amount of this zealousness that takes over, and you're just like you said, you just want to, I want to do this. So, so in my aspect, it was like, I'm going to throw out every single record I've got, and, you know, and so I threw away everything. And now I'm like, oh, you know, I look back and some of it's like, I should have gotten rid of it. That was a good call.
Right.
But there's a lot of it. I'm like, man, I really miss that album. I wish I had that one right now.
I still had it, I could sell it for three times the
amount. That's exactly right. You know, like Sergeant Pepper's or something.
Oh, yep. Yeah. I had Led Zeppelin, Aerosmith, Queen. I had multiple copies of Queen on vinyl. Yeah. Like you, I got rid of all that.
Oh,
it was
that's heartbreaking.
It was a part of my life that I just said, you know, this was the old man, and I was going to get rid of that. I was going to shed that old man's skin and you know, become whatever the new man was. And
You know, I think we all go through that. Like, I became really, like, I guess you could say I was your typical Jesus freak, as it were, in high school. And I had bumper stickers all over my car, and I wore my Christian t-shirts to school. And I live in a heavily, an area that's dominated by one religion that some people might consider a cult up here. And seriously, I mean, but it's a big, huge religion.
Right.
Comes out of Utah. I'll just say that. Anyway.
gee, which one?
Yeah, I know. That really gives it away, doesn't it? Yeah. But anyway, I mean, I was like, you know, I was just zealous, and I was wearing my shirts. And I remember one day I walked into class, and I had all of these anti-LDS books.
Uh-oh.
And I slam them down on the table to my friends, and I said, look, you're all wrong. Here's why.
Oh,
and my
no.
friends, bless their hearts, my friends, they said, Nate, we still love you. And, I mean, they just laughed it off. Do you think I changed any of their minds? Not a single one.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, I did realize at that point, maybe there's a better way to approach sharing the love of Jesus with people. And
instead of smacking people on the face.
Yeah, and maybe it doesn't mean I need to put bumper stickers all over my car or always wear, you know, turn or burn shirts or whatever I had on at the point in time. I don't know. I mean, I had some really – let me tell you, I used to work in a Christian bookstore a long time ago for years and years I worked. And I'll tell you what, I had to get out of there because I was so tired of Jesus junk. I don't even know how else to say it. And the t-shirts that they would make, I was like, seriously? Are we really going to take a bottle of Jack Daniels and turn it into a Christian t-shirt? I mean, seriously, really? How is this creative? And as Christians, as believers, we should be on the forefront, in my mind, of being creative.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
Yeah. Instead of being copiers, we need to be the people who are making, you know, the waves. But anyway, go ahead. You're going to say something.
No, I mean... I'll fall into the stereotype. Preach on, brother. I absolutely believe that. I think that, excuse me. I think that one of the problems that we have as a subculture is that when people think of Christian entertainment, they think of B quality movies, you know, or books or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, having been one that devoured a lot of that.
Yeah.
I can see where a lot of that comes from.
And there was very few books like back when I became, I mean, what was there? There was Frank Peretti.
Yeah.
And that's it. I can't really, you know, I can't think of anybody else.
Yeah. Ted Decker. Yeah. He came along a little bit later.
I, to this day, even though we sold those books like they were hotcakes when I worked at the bookstore, I have not read a single one, and
really?
I'm happy to say that, honestly. I just think they look terrible. I don't know why.
They're not bad.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for it.
Now, I haven't read them all, but you know, I've read a couple of them.
Yeah, have you? I mean, I love C.S. Lewis, and I love his science fiction, and you know, I've read the Space Trilogy and those kind of books. Just love them to death.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Tolkien and who has you know, anyway, but you know, there's we have to be, and you're talking about music, and I was huge. I was the type of person, that's why they hired me at the Christian bookstore, because people would hear a song on the radio and they would come and they could hum like a bar, and I'd say, oh yeah, that's that album, and it's on this, you know, and back then it was still tapes, right,
so
I was like,
right.
Yeah, second side, third song, you'll find it, go for it, you know, I mean, because I knew it all. But it was cheesy even back then. And then I think we're getting way off target, but that's okay. It's my show. But there was a certain time frame, probably to mid-90s to maybe the early 2000s, where I really think that Christian music was actually starting to be, in my mind at least, on the forefront. You had some great stuff that was coming out with DC Talk and Jars of Clay.
Right.
And then into the mid-2000s, you had Switchfoot and some of these bands that were really on the forefront in my mind.
Right.
And now, unfortunately, in my mind, maybe I'm wrong, but since maybe 2010 and later, we've kind of started to go like this again. And I think the Christian music industry has just gotten really just boring and generic, and most of it is praise and worship, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I want to turn on K-Love or Air One, and I want to hear a song that's not Hillsong for once.
Yeah.
Please. Can we can I hear Switchfoot again?
It might not surprise you that I almost refuse to listen to Christian radio for that very reason.
I haven't listened to it for quite a while.
I'm a CD guy.
Yes. Right? There you go.
So I still buy, and actually this is one of my favorite bands,
Theocracy.
You ever heard of them?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
Matt Smith, head guy, he absolutely a believer.
Is he?
This is what they call. I've learned a lot since because I kind of just dropped all music, but I've learned a lot about this is called melodic metal now.
Melodic metal. Okay.
Yeah. He's an excellent songwriter. I'll send you a couple of links for some stuff.
Yeah, do that. That'd be amazing.
Another guy I listen to is a guy by the name of Neil Morse. Who used to be with I'm sorry. His drummer used to be with Dream Theater.
Oh, okay.
He's prog rock. And like a lot like Yes or old Yes and Genesis and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
The 1970s.
Sticks, that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah,
gotcha.
That's almost exclusively what I listen to now.
You like that?
Because
right?
you're right. I turn on the radio and it's like. Yeah. You know, I know that I got in the car with my wife recently and I haven't listened to the radio probably in six. I mean, we've been, you know, plagued for forever.
Yeah,
and I haven't listened to the radio probably in her radio station in like 6 months. She turned it on and I'm like, you know, I don't know this song, but it sounds like every other song I've ever heard.
It does.
You know,
it's terrible.
And of course, you know, it makes her mad because she says, I like this song. I'm like, well, I'm, you know,
yeah,
I'm good. Yeah. I'm glad. But
right. And I got, you know, to me, I there's a time and place for some of the music's out there. Obviously,
sure.
Praise and worship, there's a time and place for that kind of stuff. But I don't want to listen to it every day on the radio. Is that sacrilegious? I don't know.
You know,
but I want to listen
to stuff.
Not. Yeah.
I think that too.
Yeah, I want to listen to stuff that's thought provoking. I want to listen like, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, there was Charlie
you'll
Peacock.
You'll love this stuff then.
Really? Yeah.
I
don't know if you've heard of
stuff.
Charlie Peacock or people. Well, you might want to check. I don't know what kind of music. I don't know if you listen to more metal or hard rock, but Charlie Peacock is amazing and he's really good. But he's thought provoking.
Yeah.
You know, and his lyrics aren't always, hey, God loves you and everything's going to be fine and dandy. You know, it's not this welcome, everything's fine kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It's like,
hey,
you know what? Sometimes life sucks, you know?
Right.
And let's deal with all of human emotion. And so bringing this back around on a big segue. tell me,
sorry,
man,
about that. I feel
no, you're fine, absolutely fine. I could talk music all day long. So you started writing again, I'm assuming,
yeah.
And now you're doing it from the focus of being a believer.
Yes.
But you do have this attitude of, hey, art needs to be something that is, I can't be a mimicker. I have to be somebody who's in the forefront.
Right.
Tell me how does that affect you now in writing comic books? Because comic books, I mean, let's face it, they can be pretty dark and racy and all of that kind of stuff. So so how do you do it now?
So my approach is really this, okay? Because one of the things that I found in quote unquote Christian entertainment is, you know, everything has a happy ending.
Yes.
And I get that. I do get that. But have you seen the movies God's Not Dead at All?
The first one, and that's all I can take.
Is that the one that had Hercules in it?
Yes.
Okay. So at the very end,
Kevin Sorbo.
Kevin Sorbo. He was struck by a car and
yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So when so since you've seen it, and since it's an old movie, spoilers, right? So at the end of that movie, I enjoyed the movie as a whole. Sure. But at the end of the movie, I went, they messed up. They messed up. Kevin Sorbo should not have had a come to Jesus moment in that film. He should have been smacked and gone straight to hell, because this is the real world. Right. He denied and denied and denied. And we got the conversion story through the reporter, or I forget. It's been a while since I've seen the movie. Right. Mm-hmm. But you remember it followed the reporter, and she had her conversion story. I think DC Talk is the ones who did it. Right. Mm-hmm. They're not DC Talk anymore. They're.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. Yeah. DC Talk's not. Yeah. Newsboys, is that who you're talking about?
Newsboys, thank you. Okay. Newsboys were kind of the catalyst for her to have her conversion story. Well, and then Kevin Sorbo's hit by the car, and I just said immediately, I'm like, they lost it, because what happens is if you do get people who aren't believers into the theater, they look at that and say, oh, well, you know what, it's okay. Everyone gets the opportunity to go to Jesus before they die. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, no, that's not the case. I mean, you know, in reality, Kevin Sorbo would probably have been hit by a car and died, you know? and so my approach is I try to be, or I want to be realistic in any of the fiction that and make no bones about it. Everything I'm doing is it's all fiction, right? I mean, I'm talking about superheroes and stuff like that, science fiction. And, you know, that's still my love. From, you know, I told you that's the stuff that got me to read. So that's that's still what I very much enjoy. So my attitude is that I want to be sure that God can be seen some way, somehow through the fiction. Doesn't mean that everyone is going to have, an altar call moment. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to, you know, have a happy ending. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to, you know, ultimately die and go to heaven, mm-hmm. Because I don't believe that's the way the real world is. I think that if you coat the path with gold and roses, then, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, I want to embrace the turn and burn kind of thing, but I think some of that has to be there because it's real.
Right.
Like in Cat and Mouse, the recent version of Cat and Mouse, I've just done a volume. I think I told you about that a little bit.
Yes,
I've done
a
volume two, and number three is just out. Oop, where did it go? Number three is just out, and we are shipping that. Sorry, you're gonna have to give me a moment to self.
No, you're here. Fine.
The third issue is out, and that's number three here.
Oh, wow.
This was a Kickstarter that I've still not quite fulfilled. I've got about 20. I've got about 25 packages, I think, that still have yet to be fulfilled.
Wow.
Other than that, it's mostly fulfilled. But there's a moment in there when the primary character gets in way over his head, mm-hmm. and he's just like, I don't know what to do. So he finds himself walking, and lo and behold, he ends up in a church. Did you read any of the Daredevil stories in the 1980s?
Saw the Netflix version.
Okay.
And they, from what I understand, they were pretty close.
They treat see, and here's the thing, there's you have the scale, you have the all out Christian, you know, I'm in your face, come to Jesus kind of thing, and then you got the version of Christianity as a joke, we're gonna make fun of it.
I
can't stand that, right? When Daredevil is done, I want to say Frank Miller is the guy who did it. It was his Catholicism was treated fairly. Okay. Right. He was conflicted. He had, you know, he had a faith, but he was by no means perfect.
Right.
And so that's kind of what I hope to show. But anyway, this character goes into a church and just sits there and says, you know, I'm in over my head. I need some help. If my dad was here, my dad would say, you know, and just kind of has a little, you know, back and forth. It's not long. Just kind of has a little back and forth sure. with himself and says, this is what I need to do. And he makes a decision to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so really my hope in that is to show that this character relies on a higher power to help him make decisions. He never turns to the reader and says, okay, now reader, you must come to Jesus because yeah. this is what I've done. You know, yeah. it doesn't do that. But I want to show the reader that, look, this is a character. None of the other characters have done this, but this is the character who was in over his head and he sought out a higher power because he needed help. He needed guidance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's my goal. I'm pretty sure I'm going to fail at that miserably a lot as I move forward. But that is my goal as a creator and how yeah. I hope to use my talent yeah. now for God in that something somehow, some way in what I write points to him.
Well, and that's okay. I mean, you said, if you're gonna fail, that's okay. There's grace, right?
Yes,
I mean,
that's right.
What we believe yeah. in, right? There's grace.
Yes.
And the more I read the Bible, the more I understand that it comes down to pretty much that one word,
yes.
grace. So, I appreciate that because you know there is that. Like you said, you used the phrase Christian subculture. And,
yeah.
and those of us that have been believers for a while and have been around, we understand this subculture that we exist in. And
right.
and there is a time and a place for some of these movies that are made. And
absolutely.
You know, bless them for making them. But a lot of time, I wish there would be more Christian movies, as it were, that don't have a happy ending. Like you said, that don't tie yeah. everything up at the end with a nice little bow.
Right.
Because life doesn't work that way.
No.
Not usually, you know? There may be somebody that actually comes to faith. Maybe there's somebody that's not. Maybe that person actually dies of cancer and is not healed because of prayer.
Right.
That happens. That's reality.
A lot. Yeah.
And I think people would actually be able to relate to those kind of stories more than they relate to something like, and again, it's good in its own right, but God's Not Dead or
right.
Firestarter or Fire, what was the name of that one? Fireproof. Fireproof.
Fireproof. Yeah, right.
You know, some of these other movies. And
yeah.
And I think they've made some leaps and bounds in those kind of movies.
Absolutely, I agree. Good. Yeah.
And like I said, they're not bad. Actually, some of those, especially the ones that Baptist church makes, like Fireproof.
Right.
The production quality on those are really good. Yeah, Sherwood Baptist. Good. That's right.
Sherwood Baptist.
Really good production quality on those. So I'm impressed. But, you know, I really like your approach. I think that's a good way to go for it. And like I said, I think, you know, God will bless that.
So, well, I appreciate that. I sure hope so. Do you remember The Little House on the Prairie at all?
Certainly. Watched it every day. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I've probably seen every episode at least five times.
Okay. So to me, that's almost the ideal Christian entertainment.
Sure.
Okay. Because it's not a Christian show.
No.
Right?
Right.
But it is a show about a family out on the prairie trying to make a life for themselves. And guess what? They're believers.
They also have faith. That's right.
They have faith. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not unusual that Paul fails and Maul says, now, Paul, you know, that ain't the Christian thing to do. And he says, yeah, Maul, you're right. I got to go make it better.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not an every episode kind of thing, but it's a story of a family on the prairie trying to make their life who happened to be a family of faith.
Right.
And to me, that's a perfect idea of Christian entertainment because mm-hmm. you can't watch that show and not understand how important their faith is to them. But it is not a show about being a believer,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
It's a faith about living in a small community out on the prairie.
Well, I think that's probably why it has staying power. I mean, you know, the last episode aired in what, like 84, 85, somewhere around there, you know, and people are still watching them. They still sell millions of copies of it. The DVD copies. My kids watch it, you know.
Yeah, we watched it.
Yeah,
it's a good show. My daughter got scared to death of the bears.
I remember that. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is the pace. that yep. show moves at is, you know, so yeah. slow compared to today's yeah. entertainment, but people love it. And yep. it, but it has a staying power because, like you said, it's there's something
they're
the
real.
Way they do it. Exactly.
Yeah. They're real.
It's real.
And it's not always a happy ending, and, no. and they make mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times they end up paying for their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
They learn lessons, but they're real. And yeah. I think for me, like I said, even though I know this is fiction, I know that, you know, people don't put on capes and fly around.
Yeah.
You know, I still want it to be as real as can possibly be.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that we're actually talking about this because after I when I went back for my degree, I actually went back again for another degree. I was going to go get because I taught for a little while, and then 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and then the university that I was at began to kind of lose its enrollment in because I was teaching ESL. For a while, and then they began to lose their enrollment. So around 2000, what year was that? 4, I think. Might have been 5. I'd have to go back and look. My contract wasn't renewed, and so I began to do some other things. You know, as I've tried to I went back, got a degree. God, what do you want me to do now? You know, and so I did some other things, but then I went back for an MFA. I was going to go back for a doctorate degree. I was going to go for a doctorate in creative writing with mm-hmm. my desire was to teach creative writing at a Christian university.
That was my
goal. That was what I wanted to do. I graduated and I began to apply for jobs right and left, and I could not get anybody to hire me. I think my wife and I have talked about this a lot, and I don't know the answer because, you know, that they won't give you a solid reason,
sure.
but I think some of it has to do with my past. I think they look at, you worked for Marvel Comics and you weren't a believer then. And we've seen that you did that Lita Ford thing. Oh, Lita Ford. I seen that cover. She's got some skin there, you know, and
you were
so
just doing a portrait of her.
I wasn't worth the risk. I came real close to one job. And I won't mention the university name, that's exactly what happened because the dean liked me, the department chair liked me. Everybody but one person liked me, and he didn't like me because I had done the work on Lita Ford, and also I'd worked on a book called She Devils on Wheels, which was an adaptation of a B movie from 1968. Bad movie. Okay, yeah. it's not porno, yeah. but it is. It's just a bad.
Just
it's about a. It's about yeah. It's just. It's about an all female. It's a B movie from the 60s, yeah, okay. right? It's an all female motorcycle gang who hates men.
Gang.
Oh. And so he didn't like the fact that was something I had worked on. This is part of the thing that when I have the opportunity to tell believers is like, you do have to be careful about what you do, because if you're in music or film or entertainment of any sort, that didn't go away.
No,
you can't say, I'll just do this thing and no one will ever know. Oh yeah. No. Yeah. It's forever.
Yeah, and even more so, you know, today
yes.
and with the onset of internet and cameras being everywhere and whatnot, and
mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting what will be judged on. And you're right, it
yeah.
doesn't go away. And I guess I don't understand why they don't understand that maybe that was your past and it's not your present.
I can't understand. I had a great talk with the dean after they rejected me. I had about a 3-hour long conversation with him, and he said essentially they want their department to be unanimous on all their selections. And he said uh-huh. he goes I think you would be a great asset. And so the department chair, but they had the one guy who did mm-hmm. not like it and thought it would be a bad idea. And so he was very apologetic. He was very nice.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I appreciated that. But again, it's one of those things that, you know, I had to look at and just say, you know what? Okay. That's just, you know, maybe I thought it said go left and it actually said go right.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. That makes sense. So you did, but you are still teaching.
I am teaching. I've been teaching at the Full Sail University now for over 9 years, and I teach creative writing.
Okay.
And even better than that, I teach comic books. So,
really?
Yeah. So, you know, that's one of those things where, you know, you can, you question, it's like, why didn't you let me go to this, a Christian?
So you have an actual class that you teach that is comic books.
That's what
I teach. And they pay you for it.
And they pay me for it.
Joke's on them, right?
Right.
And I'm assuming it's probably a fairly popular class.
Well, so it's because Full Sail is a different kind of university. Uh-huh. It is an entertainment university. And so
yeah. I've heard of it somehow.
Don't ever click their links. If you ever click their links, you'll see them forever. Okay. They're like Google.
I can picture the logo in my mind for some reason. Yep. So yeah, I've probably seen it.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen Game Magazine. You may, if you're on gaming sites, you've seen them. Yeah, probably. You've probably seen their ad.
Yeah.
So if you want a degree in creative writing, you have a program that you take. You sign up and you take all of these classes. So anyone that has a degree from a bachelor's, a fine arts degree from Full Sail University has had my class.
Okay,
you have to take all of the classes. They're they're not optional.
Okay.
And that's why when people get to my class and they go, I don't like comics. I'm like, you know what? You saw the class was here when you signed up, so shut up.
Yeah. Now, is Full Sail most, is it all an online school or?
Well, it is now during the plague, but not usually. It's half and half.
Okay. Gotcha.
Right, probably, that's probably more 1/3, 2/3. 1/3 on campus, 2/3 online.
I see.
Okay. We have some. Our big campus programs are film, gaming, and
That's probably where I've heard of them, is from the gaming, because my kids are all into gaming.
Oh yeah.
I have a feeling that's probably where I've heard of them. And film, you said. How long has the university been around?
It's actually been around since the late 1970s.
Okay. And I may have heard about it when I was trying to go to school, because I was in the film department at my university when I went.
Oh, cool.
I studied film for a while. And
I think they've only been big for like the last 20 years, though.
Has it? Okay.
Yeah. I think in the 70s, they were run out of like an RV. something like that. They had like some sort of recording studio in an RV.
Oh, okay.
And that's the way the university got started.
Yeah.
Started by a believer, actually. Okay. Yeah.
Nice.
Yep.
And that's in now. Where are you living now? Is that?
I live in the Orlando, Florida area.
Oh, okay, and that's where the university's at.
Yep, the university's in Winter Park.
Okay, gotcha. Yep. Great. Well, Roland, it's been a fantastic conversation. We've had a nice long talk. This is great.
We have enjoyed it.
Well, good. I'm glad. Thank you for even coming back and talking with me again, and saying some of the same stuff. But I think we had a different conversation and we found out some more stuff.
I think we did too. Yep.
It's been a pleasure.
Like I warned you, it's easy to get me talking about the things that I love, right?
Yeah.
You have to stop me, because I love comics, I love history, and I love me some Jesus. So it's easy to talk about those things.
Well, I think we hit most of that stuff tonight, and I appreciate you calling me out. And the only reason I'm stopping is because I got a feeling, an hour and a half is about as much time as most people will want to listen to a podcast.
Yeah. So they're going to shut up already.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I think there's a lot of people that are going to really groove on what we've talked about tonight. And there was a gentleman that I can't think of his name right now. He's the one that introduced me to you. And his name totally escaped me. I interviewed him as well. But I guess you were on a podcast with him. What is his name? Bo Chappell?
Chappell? Yeah.
And he just,
I know the name from Twitter.
Yeah. He's pretty prevalent on Twitter, but he says, you got to talk to this guy. You'll love him. So.
Oh, very cool. Anyway, I'll have to thank him for that.
And it has been a pleasure. And maybe one day I'd love to meet you face to face. I think it'd be kind of fun.
Sounds great. The pleasure would be all mine. I would love to get up your way.
Please do.
I've never been to a convention up your way, and I would absolutely love to make that happen.
Well, and we had kind of we have FanExus in Salt Lake City, Utah, and that's a pretty big one. In fact, I think it's one of the bigger Comic-Cons in the West.
Cool.
In fact, they used to call themselves Salt Lake Comic-Con, and they're so big that Comic-Con sued them for their name.
That. Wow.
And so that's why they'll call themselves FanX. That they have to call it FanX because San Diego Comic-Con was a little, I guess they didn't like how big they were getting or something. But we actually started one. Some people in a little town down the road from me in Pocatello, Idaho, they started their own Comic-Con. There was only a few hundred people, but it was really cool. And then the guy got sick and he hasn't been able to do it again. I guess he got cancer, but
oh.
But maybe you can make it to the Salt Lake Comic-Con or something. Did Did I say that? Sorry, Comic-Con. The Salt Lake Fanex someday. And you could, I'd love to. But even if you guys made it up to come to Yellowstone National Park or something like that, stop by and give me a holler. And
I will tell you, when I left California and we moved home, I told my wife, I said, because coming out here, we took I-20, which is just straight through Oklahoma and Texas, straight through, right? And I told my wife, I said, when we go home, I said, let's go up, you know, through that. So I've actually been to Pocatello. I stayed all night there one night. Because we drove up through Nevada and we went through, we went to look at the dinosaur thing in Wyoming. We went through Salt Lake, sort of stayed in Pocatello, went through Yellowstone, stayed in Billings, Montana.
Well, then you've driven through my town as well, because I'm in Idaho Falls, Idaho, just 40 miles north on Idaho, on Interstate 15. So you drove through my town on the way to Yellowstone, I'm sure.
I had to go see, we were going to go see Yellowstone, but I had to go see the Little Bighorn, you know, as a history guy.
Sure, sure.
I had to go see it.
You know, so I've been, I spent a week in Billings, and I've never been to the Little Bighorn. Never.
Really?
You know. Yeah. But well, I mean, there's so much history around here as far as, you know, Indian battles and things like that are concerned.
Well, if you didn't know, Custer was an idiot.
Actually, I did my senior paper in high school on Custer. So, yeah, I'm well aware of his of Mr. Son of the Morning Star's mistakes there. I'll tell you that.
I have that book. I've read that book.
Yeah, that was my the biggest book I used for my references on that paper was that book right there. So
Cool.
Yeah. Long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So Roland, it was great talking to you.
I'm still talking.
That's all right. It's getting late where you're at. I better let you go. So
I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay.